Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 8th, 2002. Today's session is entitled Nurturing the Moral and Spiritual Lives of Children. Educating children, helping them discern their vocations, and learning from them. It is presented by Marcia Bungie, and it is number BUM2002-09. Let's listen in.
Maybe some more people come, but this week I'm focusing on these issues about nurturing the moral and spiritual lives of children. So we're concentrating on these general questions that you can look on that little white sheet. Just what are your own concerns about families and children? What's positively shaped your own moral and spiritual development that you could think would help other children? And what are some of the best ways to nurture the moral and spiritual lives of children in our midst? How can the church and state more effectively support children and families? And what are some of the obstacles in our families, in our religious communities, in our culture, in our country to attending to the needs of children and helping them mature morally and spiritually? And how could we all work together more diligently to protect and nurture children in our midst? I've gotten very interested in issues of children and young people, because we have two kids of our own, because I teach at a church-related college, and we're always talking about the whole person, not just helping these young people develop academically, but also morally, spiritually, at a church-related college. And I'm just concerned about, as many of you, I think, some of the challenges that a lot of families, a lot of young people are facing today. So I had put together about 8 ways that I found to be very emphasized in the history of Christianity, but also by sociologists and psychologists today who talk about the needs of children. And so we spent Monday looking at examples and family service projects, Tuesday reading and discussing the Bible and interpretations of it, carrying out family rituals and traditions. And yesterday we talked about music, the importance of music. That's not something so emphasized, I think, in the church, although I find among my students music groups, and then we talked about the natural world and cultivating the reference for creation. Those two things have been very powerful in the lives of young people, very life-shaping. And so today we're going to talk about educating children, helping them discern their vocation, and learning from children. So I hope you jump in anytime. I'm going to say just a few words about vocation, what that means. And I think a lot of young people, it's very much related to finding ways to contribute to the common good and finding ways to serve others. And a lot of young people are longing for this. I have so many students, we tend to think of young people as cynical and pessimistic. And some of them are, but a lot of them really want to talk with older people about how they can contribute and ways they can contribute to society. So this is one wonderful vehicle in the tradition for helping to do that. So anyway, just jump in anytime. I'm going to just say a few words about vocation, because I think it's often misunderstood, that word vocation. Unfortunately, it's a very rich concept. I think it helps us really talk about some of our deepest longings, about ways we can contribute and serve, but it's misunderstood, even in the church. And I've done this big grant for the Lilly Endowment. I was directing this big grant on vocation, and we were talking to a lot of students, and even among my colleagues, the three ways people thought about what is vocation, the first one was, it's your occupation, it's your paid work. And so it's kind of reduced to just how you get paid. And some other people think of it as vocation, not so much your paid work, but where you find self-fulfillment, what makes you personally happy. It's kind of a spiritual gloss on your own personal self-fulfillment. So a lot of my students will talk that way, say, I want to find my vocation, but they're really, it's very sort of inward, very personal. You don't get this sense of service. Or a kind of way they can contribute. It's very much what sort of feels good, whether they're paid or not. So, and then among Catholics especially, the word vocation is often equated with becoming a priest, a monk, or a nun. In fact, the Catholic colleges that got these big grants is $2 million. It was fantastic from the Lilly Endowment, because they want to encourage reflection on vocation among college students. And the Catholic institutions that got it, they couldn't call their projects vocation. They couldn't have the word vocation in it because everybody thought it just meant, oh yeah, those are for the kids who want to become priests and monks or nuns. So the term in the tradition is a very rich term that has a lot of varied interpretations. But in general, I'll just say that in a lot of traditions within the Catholic, within the Christian Church, emphasize these things, that vocation is mainly about being called to use one's gifts and talents, to love and serve others, to contribute to the common good and care for creation. So, and by doing this, by using one's gift to serve others, to contribute, one is thereby participating in God's care and redemption of the world. So it has this really strong sense of a larger purpose. You're using your gifts and talents. Those are unique to you. It's very individual. It's out to serve others. And by doing that, you're part of a much wider purpose, God's way of serving others. So in general, that's the way a lot of Christian traditions talk about the notion of vocation. So it's not just occupation, because a lot of ways we serve others isn't just through our paid work. And it's not just self-fulfillment, because it's not just what makes us feel good, but it has this outward dimension of serving others. And it's not just becoming a priest, monk, or nun, because there are many and diverse ways that we can serve others and contribute to the common good. Within the tradition, Martin Luther spent a lot of time really talking about vocation and helped us kind of expand that notion of what vocation means. And he emphasized the same kind of general thing, that God calls everyone to use their gifts and talents, to love and serve others, contribute to the common good, and it's part of God's larger purpose, so that everybody's needs are met and we kind of work together as a whole. But he also talked about very specific kinds of vocations, and might also kind of think of this as vocation with a large V and this with a small V, that everybody has particular places of responsibility, particular stations in life, particular roles, you might say, or places of responsibility in which they serve others. And that can be, for Luther, it was in the home. It could also be in your profession and also in civic life. So, you know, again, it isn't just that, you know, you've got a paid profession and that's what your vocation is. Also, being a parent is a vocation. Being a son or daughter for him was a vocation. What does it mean to be an aunt and uncle? You have a kind of place of responsibility in your relationships to others, and that's a wonderful thing. And seeing that it's part of a larger purpose is very helpful, he said. In fact, he has a wonderful essay on the estate of marriage, and he talks about how, you know, being a spouse is really a vocation. And he's so frank sometimes, you know, just about how bad it can all be. And this estate of marriage is kind of, he said, man, you know, I know it's tough in marriage. You know, you wonder, what have I done? What was I thinking? Why did I marry this person? And he said that sometimes that it helps to kind of think, well, it's kind of a place of responsibility. A lot of good things happen out of this marriage. We're able to take care of the children. We're able to help the neighborhood by taking care of our children. And by seeing that as something divinely instituted, divinely ordained, that's something positive. You get a little larger sense of purpose than just, why did I make this terrible mistake? That the place of responsibility itself has some dignity and value, and that can carry you through some of the tough times in marriage. So, and he said everybody has a vocation. A child has a vocation to be a son or daughter, a good son or daughter. So it's kind of neat the way he talked about these places of responsibility in which we serve others. In his time, these were almost fixed, like you have certain stations where if your dad was a shoemaker, you know, you're probably going to be a shoemaker, and you don't talk about career choices very often. And women, basically, their vocation was to be a mother, a spouse, or a son and daughter. There wasn't really any other kind of public vocation. But I think we can still use his understanding today, even though he talked about it as more sort of fixed, even though we make career choices, that it's still a very helpful notion, I think. He also talked about what I think is very helpful today, is that we have multiple responsibilities and duties. that because our vocation is lived out not just in our professions but in the home and in civic life, you're kind of balancing a lot of aspects of your particular vocation. So, for example, a doctor might be a spouse, and a doctor might also be on the city council. A doctor might also be a parent. And all those, for Luther, are part of your vocation, your particular places of responsibility, and, you know, a need to kind of balance those. So it's nice because it really, I think people struggle with that today. They feel a sense of kind of calling to their work, what they're doing there, but also the home, about what they're doing maybe for their neighborhood or politically. And he addressed that kind of, it includes multiple responsibilities and duties. Another nice thing he emphasized that I think we struggle with today is that this notion of vocation explodes a kind of ranking mentality we have, where one kind of thing you're doing is better than another. I know among my students, if you're a pre-med, that's still seen as, oh, you're somebody. You know, you're a neat person. Law for some is still among a lot of my students seen as very good, whereas becoming a teacher, it's almost like still seen as a little lower than another way you could serve. For parents, too, I think it's a struggle. You have a ranking mentality yourself for your children, what they're supposed to become. And I think the nice thing about this vocation idea is that it explodes some of this ranking mentality. So Luther did a great service, I think, by expanding the notion of vocation to honor activities not just in your work, paid work, but also in the home and in civic life, by honoring, you know, duties as parents, spouses, sons and daughters, aunts and uncles, and furthermore, honoring our responsibilities as citizens and getting out in public life. So it's a really, I think it's a very valuable concept today when young people are searching for ways to contribute, when we're all kind of searching for ways to contribute to society. It's a wonderful kind of concept to help us get beyond just what's your career choice, how are you going to pay for it, what kind of money you're going to make afterwards. It's a much richer way of talking about your life commitments and your future goals. Because if you really think and reflect about vocation, you have to ask a lot more questions than just what does it pay, how do people regard this job. You have to ask questions like, what are my special gifts and talents? How can I use them to serve and love others? You have to ask a lot of questions about what are the needs of people around me? And how can I contribute to the common good? Is there a larger purpose in my life? Is God calling me to do something? And do my goals fit with my values and beliefs? It even helps us with that struggle of balancing responsibilities, because it helps you ask, if I get married, if I maybe have children, how will I balance my commitments to my family, my work, and to my community? So it's a very rich concept in that way, and I think it's a very rich concept today when we're so focused on individualism and on self-fulfillment. It really kind of shatters what Putnam has called, you know, this age of bowling alone, because it does emphasize getting out the service and our civic and parental responsibilities. So
when you, I was just thinking, when would you start dialoguing with kids about this? But I could also see it being very informal, you know, just a kind of a drippy method as the kids get older and older, you know. Just talking about different roles in the community, different responsibilities you have.
And really, I think tying it to a kind of larger purpose. And I'm going to put out some ideas I have of how do you help young people and children discern their more specific vocations, because that's a challenge. And I'd love you to hear what you have done in your own families or with young people you love and care about. But I think that's a very good thought you have about the sort of dripping method. Just keep chipping away at it and keep bringing it into the conversation. And ways you can do that is, first of all, even when they're young, to see them as images of God, and that they are called to love and serve others and contribute to the common good. That's kind of what they're called to do in a Christian perspective, that's their purpose in life, to get out there, to love others, contribute to the common good, and care for creation. So seeing them that way from the beginning, I think, is very helpful. A second thing I think helps a lot is to emphasize responsibilities in their current vocation. You know, if Luther is right and says everybody, young people, old people, everybody, all people have these places of responsibility. A young, what does it mean to be a son or a daughter? What are your responsibilities as a child in our household? And I think it's just very helpful right now, too, when we have a hard time, I think, cultivating a child's sense of responsibility. I find, even among my friends, it's almost like they have no responsibilities till like 18. And then it's like, hey, it's too late. I have friends, even their children are 14, they have no chores, literally no chores, partly because the parents said it takes so much time to teach them. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of...
There's the parent's vocation.
Yes, the parent's vocation to help cultivate.
Vocation to do that.
Yeah. But some of them, I mean, even I said, hey, man, even like, hey, shine the shoes in Germany. I have some friends, you know, they're very big on shiny shoes in Germany. I mean, it's like, it's really bad if you don't have nice looking shoes. So I said, well, don't they even help with the shoes? Well, we tried it once. That's a little messy, you know. And so that was it. I mean, there is nothing there. I think it's very good to help cultivate that. We've started to do that with our college students. Because I think they think, too, of the student life as a kind of free-for-all. Mm-hmm. But they have responsibilities. They have duties as students. What does it mean to be, you know, in this place as a student in this university? What are your responsibilities? What are the expectations we have of you? And that's kind of helped, too, to see they have a current vocation. We're not just waiting and waiting for them till they're 24, 27. Then they're going to have responsibilities. They have responsibilities all along the way. So I think that's kind of helpful. And then, of course, discussing vocation, as you speak about your life goals and future commitments, not just their life goals and future commitments, but how you kind of reflect on your own and to think out loud with your children. You know, a lot of people change careers every 5 years, I understand, we're changing careers. And how people kind of make those decisions to think out loud with your children about that. And this notion of vocation really does, you know, help bring up so many wonderful questions about, gosh, I've got to think about my special gifts. I've got to think about where are the needs around me. How might I help meet some of those needs of others? It helps you really... You know, talk about the difficulties of trying to balance these many responsibilities that you have and how you're juggling them, how you think about that spiritually. And it just gets you beyond those questions of just career and just finances to talk about a kind of larger sense of purpose. So I think it's very good in fighting cynicism, pessimism. It's a wonderful kind of rich discussion among parents and children as all of them think about their future commitments and life goals. And then I think it's very helpful also to help young people name and recognize these things, their gifts and talents, the needs of others, and particular ways to serve. And there's lots of ways to do that, but just naming a person's gifts is very important. And I have young people, I'll give you just one example. I had a student who was going to be an engineer. He would have been a very good engineer. But he also had tremendous gifts for ministry, for ordained ministry. And I wrote a little tiny comment on one of his papers. He was a tremendous leader in discussions, just fantastic, thoughtful papers. So I wrote a thing, I said, you know, you really have a lot of gifts for ministry. Have you ever thought about being an ordained minister? And he came in my office. And he said, you know, I have thought about that, but no one ever said anything. And it was kind of seen in his family as, that's not a good idea. A pastor compared to an engineer? Please, honey, you know, what are you thinking? So it wasn't opened up as a part of discussion. So once you just named it, I mean, it was so casual. I was not a serious mentor of this young person. You know, we hadn't spent days and hours together. I just happened to name it. And then it was so neat because the campus pastor, just the week later, happened to mention, because he gave a little reflection in our campus worship service, that he had, you know, good gifts for ministry too. So it turned out it was a deep calling that he had, but no one had named it, and that's a real service we can do for young people. I think it's also, you know, very nice. I said, how do you do that? How do you name gifts? How do you find out more about needs of others around you, how to find about ways to serve. is certainly contact with caring adults and role models. And it's, I think it's very important to have other people besides the parents naming those gifts. All kinds of psychologists and sociologists talk about how it's so important to have more than just the parents being, having other adults being concerned about your children. And sometimes they can name better than you as a parent can what that child's gifts are. Partly because you have your own desires and expectations for this person because of your own background or maybe your own unfulfilled desires and wishes. And so sometimes someone outside can name it better. So it's good to get your kids out there working with some caring adults so those adults can get to know them and start to name what are their special gifts and talents. When talking to our students at our college about what happened to them before they came to college that they found meaningful in terms of, you know, helping to name and recognize their specific vocation, these are some of the things they said. This contact with caring adults, of course, and role models. People who are able to really talk about how they combine faith, work, family life, and civic commitments. You know, and are articulate about that and can talk about the hard realities of trying to combine all those responsibilities. They love that. Also, certainly prayer, meditation, spiritual fellowship, a service project with adults. Those are very powerful, partly because young people start getting leadership skills. They see in the group working together on some project, wow, you know, I'm really good at organizing. I didn't realize I had that capacity to do that. So they learn a lot about their own skills, and they certainly learn about the needs of others. And you can do that in many ways. One family I know, they go every year down to Mexico with a Habitat for Humanity, and their children have learned a lot of good skills, have honed their own skills, and learned about the needs of others that way. Cross-cultural experiences are very helpful too, because that could either be in another country, time spent in another country, or even in another cultural setting in our own country. I think if you've ever gone abroad, you know how many questions it raises for yourself about, gee, why do I do the things I do? Why do we run things like this instead of like that? Why does our political system have these commitments when this one has this other commitment? So it's a very wonderful way of opening up all kinds of questions about your individual talents, but needs of others, about what you want to do politically. Those have been important for young people I've talked to. Certainly also church camps and wilderness experiences like Holden. People talk about, you know, so much goes on in their children's lives here at Holden, in this larger community. That kind of, oh, and if you go to these staff meetings, you can just sneak in on one. I think they're Wednesday nights at 7, where they talk about is the volunteers who come here, old and young, and the testimonies people give about what they learned about themselves and how other people help name their gifts and how they, you know, found out about how they can serve by serving others here at this village. It's quite a powerful testimony. So that way, certainly study and reflection. I think reading about the needs of others, reading about the lives of people who have been able to go out there and serve others and have this larger sense of purpose is also really helpful for young people. Just one last point, and then maybe we could add some more examples. But I have found, and this is important in the tradition too, that it's strongly emphasized, you'll find this everywhere, you should be highly involved in your child's education. And you better make sure that you get your kids a great education. And furthermore, you gotta help other children have a good education. And this is emphasized time and again, especially, well, the Reformation had a tremendous emphasis on wonderful education for all children. For example, Luther, he said, you know, if you make the Bible your supreme authority, not the Bible in the church, in talking about spiritual matters, well, then you better be able to read, right? So everybody's got to read, read the Bible, or you're not going to get very far spiritually. So that was one reason they really pushed the education. If you say the Bible alone, which is one of the principles of the Reformation, has sole authority, then boy, you better get out there and read. But if you read these guys, Luther, Calvin, Melanchthon, you find they also said, we've got to help people, you know, train them with their skills and their talents so they can get out there and serve the community. So it wasn't just Bible interpretation, although that was important. They said, boy, if we want good doctors, we want good lawyers, we want good politicians, we've got to have excellent education for them. So like in the Reformation, Luther and Melanchthon, they did tremendous educational reform. They encouraged that all people, including, you know, girls and boys, rich and poor, which was unusual at the time, should have an education. And so, and he wrote, Luther wrote some very strong letters to councilmen, to the princes of the day, saying, you have a very strong responsibility to provide an excellent education for all your citizens. I love this letter Luther wrote to some councilmen, talking about the importance of well-educated citizens. It's everybody. And he said that a well-educated citizens serve both church and society and are a city's best and greatest welfare, safety, and strength. Not your arms, you know, not your artwork necessarily. It's the citizens who are well-educated. They are your greatest strength and welfare. So he advised politicians that no effort should be spared to provide good education for all children. And he also said to have great libraries filled with books from all the arts and sciences. So Luther had that one saying once, he, you know, what would he want? What is a good shoemaker? What's a Christian shoemaker? A Christian shoemaker isn't one who makes crummy shoes with little crosses on them. A Christian shoemaker is somebody who makes great shoes. Or like a Christian doctor is not maybe someone who necessarily wears a little cross going in the operation room, but a really great doctor who knows how to do the operation. So anyway, they had a strong emphasis. I did a lot of work on another person named Franca. He was a 17th, 18th century Lutheran. He started a lot of hospitals, orphanages, and one really fascinating thing for me about this guy was he lived at a time when you would never think about having poor children go to the university. You know, it wasn't worth it. You have maybe apprentices to be shoemakers or be something else. But even if a young person were highly talented and were poor, you would never send them on to university. But he really emphasized this notion, everybody's got gifts and talents. And he had these wonderful orphanages where if a child, rich or poor, really showed some gifts, that person would be sent to the university, you know, to go on and be a doctor, lawyer, whatever. So it was quite moving, especially when you compare him to John Locke, who lived around the same time. John Locke is often held up as the great child advocate. And he was a child advocate in the sense of he said, hey, kids have reason. You don't have to beat the hell out of them. You know, let's stop just beating them up. And it's a really beautiful book he's written about children. But when it came to poor children, his words are almost don't even sound like Locke. And this guy, John Gay, who's done a lot on this period, says, oh, it just sounds so inhumane, because when he starts talking about poor children, he says, well, you know, really, you need to whip them, put them in these workhouses, give them a little sense of religion, and send them on their way. But whereas Franca, who had this very strong sense of vocation, said, oh, no, you know, you got to give them all. I don't care what class they come out. And so in a very class-conscious society, this notion of vocation enabled him to kind of explode that notion, you don't help poor kids. So that's really what's very striking for me. Let me just add very briefly, and maybe we can then open up the discussion. I was saying let's just stop there for a second. What other things have you found really help young people as they try to discern their vocation and discern ways that they can serve others? Or what are some of the obstacles that get in the way to doing that?
I think one of the things that is an obstacle is when people say to children, so young adults, what is it you want to be? What is it you want to, you know, in terms of a paid vocation, this is your job. and had two very lovely friends who gave me quite an insight once when I realised what they said to their children is, what do you want to be like when you grow up? So it got them thinking about the kind of person they wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I think it seems such a big task of what you want to be and how children know in their lives, even to quite late in adolescence, is the immediate past and the immediate present, and that there are things in the immediate times for adolescents that are very, very important to them.
Mm-hmm.
And we're constantly trying to get them to work against their psychology
mm-hmm.
to think to the future.
Mm-hmm.
But to be, I liked your notion of responsibilities in the current vocation and the kind of person you want to be,
mm-hmm.
you can start being that straight away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the difference between being who you are and what you'll be paid for might be very different to your vocation.
Mm-hmm.
Because you might just have a job enough to earn money mm-hmm. to live, but your real vocation is mm-hmm. something else, like mm-hmm. singing in a choir, but you can't get paid for it. But this is the thing that, mm-hmm. you know, is your gift.
Mm-hmm. Your gift and that you're contributing to the community that way.
So that distinction between paid work and...
Yeah.
and vocation
yeah.
to be made.
And I think it's very hard in our culture now where really you are kind of measured with what kind of job you have and how much it pays. It's so hard to get out of that mentality, I think. You just identify yourself so much with your work. And, you know, last night you were talking about just how much time we spend at work, just working. And so you do tend to almost see yourself equated with that job. And it's very hard in this kind of market economy, and to get past that sense. The guy who talked about being a bus driver last night,
mm-hmm.
wasn't that interesting? Was everybody there last night? Yeah, just about, well, a bus driver, you know, you think of that as like, wow, that's sad. You know, hey, I mean, you know, okay, the guy must have not had time to go to school. I don't know, too bad. He's not in jail, but he's the bus driver. You know what I mean? But then the way he talked about it, it had this sense of, he said, I'm the first person the kids see in the morning, besides their parents. I'm the last person after school. And so he saw it as, I'm really contributing to the lives of these kids by the way I'm serving them in this job as the bus driver. Mm-hmm. That was very moving. And at Luther College, I don't know if it's still the same way, I found the people who help clean up you know, the janitors and stuff, a lot of young people have jobs with them, you know, work study. And they saw themselves as mentors to these young people, helping them discern their gifts. Very rich. The Intersections, it's kind of a magazine for church-related colleges, just did a thing on vocation, partly because a lot of these schools got these big grants on vocations. Everybody's thinking about vocation or wanting to get a grant from Lilly to help them think about vocation. And on their front cover, you know, they put the person who's helping construction, the baker, the gardener, as a kind of, that's the front of the English professors there too. But it's not just, you know, the professors who have the great vocation at the university. It's all these people working together. This guy, Paul Dovery at Concordia College, he did a wonderful thing often too, I understand, where he had a procession from the physical plant to the chapel, and everybody who was serving the community, as the cooks at the church-related college, as the mechanics, the people working in the physical plant, all processed up there, and there was a kind of naming of their service in this community that we're all working together to make this happen. So beautiful, that ritual.
I'm just wondering if the term, you know, using, I assume it's the Latin.
Vocatio.
Yeah, that, why don't we just say calling?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, that term always works better, and I use it with people and talk to kids about that, you know. What do you call to
yeah.
do? And it somehow seems like it has more immediacy than vocation, which sounds like a
mm-hmm.
less, for some reason.
But don't yeah. you also think they have the confusion with that well, then I'm called to be a pastor. You know, the same thing with uh-huh. the confusion with the Catholic vocation of being priest non-calling, I think most of the time our kids even confuse that with saying, well, I don't feel called to be in ministry or youth ministry or whatever. Now, I think it's becoming more acceptable that we're called in whatever vocation we're in. And that's part of what this whole Lilly Grant process is all about.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the colleges are splitting those into the vocations of the church or just the vocations that we're going to pursue in our life.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything is a calling.
Mm-hmm.
And so as that becomes more commonly used, I think people are more comfortable with it. But
mm-hmm.
it's,
yeah, so you're saying maybe you run into trouble that way too.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, I think that can be used too. People talk about that, the calling. I found a lot of people get this sense calling too, but vocation as well. It's something so inward and mysterious as God's speaking to you. And if you didn't hear it, you know, probably God's not really in tune with you, and it doesn't matter what you do, kind of, you know. So it's been interesting that even though we say yes, there are times you get this sort of inner voice. A lot of people, when they talk about how did you find out what are your gifts, how you're going to serve, it's more through relationships these ways, with service, with cross-cultural experience, with prayer with other people, the community, this you know, there are some traditions too where it's very much more a community process. Let's sit down with you, let's talk together about what you're thinking about doing, and it's much more communal. And that's the kind of sad thing about, I think, religion in general. It's seen as very private, so private you don't talk to anybody about it, and God's going to speak to you privately, when really it's a lot through relationships. I think I mentioned this one example of this Wendell Berry book, The Jaber Crow. He's got this whole, it's a very beautiful little novel, but a whole kind of discussion about vocation. He's an orphan in a Christian orphanage, and the best thing you could be if you want to do anything as an orphan in a Christian institution is become a pastor. So he thinks he hears this little inward call one night. It's kind of mysterious outside. The stars are out. Seems like he's hearing a call to be a pastor. And so he has this beautiful line where, well, I don't know if I really heard the call, but I thought I better follow it just in case I hadn't heard it. But he ends up being a barber, serving others in a community. And so it's a beautiful, and the barber, it was picked, it's a beautiful kind of, you know, people say, why did they make the protagonist the barber? But there's something very humble about it. Again, you know, the barber cutting the hair, it's very physical and a kind of humble profession. So anyway, but he shows how much he contributes through that vocation, you know, part of it as this barber and gravedigger, basically.
And the barbers talk with him. A lot of the civil rights movement, people say, the hairdressers in the South, and they would talk this kind of stuff because it was the Rosa Parks of the world and stuff. This is where they can safely have those conversations.
That Grace and I were both on the dish team today, and as we would make it a bit more interesting, we're having a conversation. We were following on from your discussion about heroes the other day, and how we decided we'd look for what would be heroes that are never ever noticed. And I think it fits in with this, and one of the ones we came up with is, I don't know if you call them checkout chicks here, but you know, kids that, teenagers that work, or young people that work in supermarkets, the checkout, and the one that really takes time to talk to the elderly person who maybe lives alone, has no one else to talk to them, and affirms them and takes the time with them, and greets them and knows them every day that they come. And because they really care. It's kind of like a caring ministry in the job of a checkout person.
Mm-hmm.
And those kinds of people that really do that kind of a job with a whole spirit.
Yeah.
They're the kinds of things to admire.
Mm-hmm.
Because no one will ever put them on a front page of a magazine.
Right.
But they are really, really important to the health of elderly people or lonely people in the community.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. I think for young people today, too, when there is a lot of uncertainty with the job market and they're so worried about things, too, when you change jobs a lot. I've seen some of my friends devastated when they thought their vocation was their occupation and they lost their job. And they're not gonna get that job back. I'm not gonna get that same job back. It took them a long time to see maybe they still have those gifts and talents. They don't have that same job, but they maybe can use them in other ways to serve other people. But it's I think it's almost like a nice practical thing too in this day and age where we don't have the same job forever and ever. And to equate it with your occupation can, you know, it's certainly not life-giving, but it's also hard if you lose that job. You know, some friends of mine who didn't get tenure, it took them a long time to kind of rethink, how could I use my gifts if I didn't have this particular job? Maybe I just want to say a couple things about this because I'd like to hear your thoughts and we can come back to vocation, but one thing I think hasn't been so emphasized in the tradition that's emphasized in the gospel so beautifully is that adults learn a lot from children. That we think of children, I put at the beginning of this little white handout for today, just a little reminder because I think we do have these narrow views of children as I put as commodities, consumers, economic burdens, as pure, innocent children, dark or sinful adolescents, as kind of on their way to being human. But they're gifts of God, sources of joy, sinful creatures, moral agents, developing beings in need of instruction. They're fully human and worthy of dignity and respect. And one thing that's so interesting in the Gospels is they're seen as models of faith, as not just, you know, getting instruction, but actually being models for adults. Or they're seen as vehicles of revelation. I want to say just a couple of things about each of them. Or moral witnesses. Moral witnesses in the sense of they witness our actions and are almost like the very, very intimate witnesses of what we're doing and also raise a lot of questions for us morally. So I'm not going to say much about that, but just in the, I gave that one little yellow hand sheet of the gospel. You could just look a second at that. Because it's very striking, these passages. At a time when really children have a very low position in society, we're really seen as property. For Jesus to use these examples of children, it's almost like bizarre that he's doing that. Like if you look at the one, Matthew 18, 2 to 5, unless you change and become like children. Let's see, I think that's on the... it'd be on the front part where it says Gospels, welcoming children in my name, Matthew 18, 2 to 5. Truly, I tell you, if you could start at 2, he called a child, he put him among them and said, truly, I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever becomes humble like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever welcomes such a child in my name is welcoming Jesus. That's a very wild thing to say in this period, even today. If any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones, believe in me, it would be better for you if you had a great millstone were fastened around your neck and you were drowned in the depth of the sea. Or if you look at, let's see, I have Luke 18 at the bottom. People were bringing infants to him that he might touch them, and the disciples saw it, and they sternly ordered them not to do that. But Jesus called them and said, let the children come to me, do not stop them, for it is to such as these that the kingdom of God belongs. Truly I tell you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child will never enter it. So these are really kind of wild passages. And a lot of theologians have spent some time thinking, what does it mean to become like a little child? What does that mean? And I'm just going to mention a couple because I find them so interesting, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about this too. Some talk about, well, Schleiermacher, he was a 19th century theologian, and he said, children are models for adults in the sense that they're able to live in the present. They don't have this anxiety about the future or the past. They're able to live fully in the present. And he thought that was a kind of spiritual maturity, to be able to live in the present. And that's a model for adults, to give away some of that anxiety about the future or the past. Or he said in another sermon that children are models for adults in the sense that they keep adults fresh and cheerful. They assist adults in advancing along the path of sanctification. Children remind us of the fact God created humanity to live simply, is what Schleiermacher said. They help adults session with the complexities of work and public life. They draw adults back into the most basic of human relationships. So in that sense, they're models. He also said they're very flexible and forgiving. If you've ever noticed that about children, it's so amazing how they can, you know, be kind of a, really upset about something, and boy, where I could carry a grudge a really long time. You know, they're like ready to go on. Oh, okay, that's over. Let's go on to the next topic. So he thought that was what made children models for adults. Or just one last example was from Karl Rahner. He's this 20th century Catholic theologian, and he had this beautiful essay on childhood and said that they are examples to us because they lack false ambition and artificiality. They don't seek honor or fame, and they are guileless and serene. So he talks about their kind of living in a spiritually mature state, which is required to enter the reign of God, and they have this attitude, what he called of infinite openness and wonder, a kind of infinite openness and wonder, which he thought was a kind of thing we have to take up as adults. So anyway, there's been a lot of reflection about that and about children being vehicles of revelation. That doesn't mean they're closer to God, but sometimes what they say or what they do opens you up to something true about God or about yourself.
They're questions. They're really honest.
Yeah, very honest. This Robert Coles, who does so much with children, he says they're almost like new people in the company or new people, you know, on the job. And they're going like, why do you do things like that?
Yeah.
Or there's a guy, Matthews is his name, he's a philosopher, and he's done all this stuff on how children are great philosophers because they ask such fresh questions, just like this, like, why are you doing like that? So in that sense, they're kind of moral witnesses because they see everything you do. Mm-hmm. They are checking it out, and they're also asking those kind of fresh questions. Why do you do that? And I think listening to them, not seeing it just as cute, but really listening to them, you learn a lot. I don't know what else you thought you'd learn from children. I'd love to hear if, you know, that rings true to you in any way.
Well, I have found, not that they are looking at me, but that even when they aren't seeing what I'm doing, they could be asleep, they could, you know, I could be off at work or somewhere else, but knowing that I want to be a good model to them, I think makes me much more aware and attentive of the decisions I make and the things that I do. And even if they're far away, I know this is turning me into the kind of person that I want them to know and see. And so it doesn't really matter if they're there seeing me or not. I'm sure I'm more aware of the things that I do, and I make different decisions than I would have if I hadn't been so aware I'm a model to my kids.
Yeah, just taking that sense, that this place of responsibility as a parent kind of makes you think, well, how do I want to orient my life? A lot of people talk about how you would mature so much yourself being a parent because of what you're saying. Even if you don't think they're seeing it directly, you're forcing yourself to ask about your own priorities, about your own values, what you want them to see.
I remember the best bit of advice I was given when my children were quite young. Someone said to me, before you go and scold your children about something that you're not happy with, have a look at yourself first and see if you can see any of the roots of any. And I have to say that it really makes me bite my tongue often and go and change my behavior on something. When I'm really unhappy with something that my children are doing, I think, how am I in this?
Yeah.
And I find it's not what I've said, it's what I do. Impact on them.
Kind of prompting your own self-reflection.
Oh, yeah. Even I go fix it up and then I go tell them off.
Yeah.
Not really.
I know even as a with a little baby, it's not what you say to them or you know how you take care of them, but it's how you respond with your face that they're looking at and what they react to. You could be saying something really nice, and if you're not feeling it or responding with your face, it's not going to mean anything.
And that it's, I love this, all this research they're doing on early child development, because I think it helps to lift up this sense, these are human beings. They are not, you know, just kind of economic burdens or accessories or however you want to talk about them, you know, our little consumers that we're kind of developing to buy things. I love that early child development because it's so complex, isn't it? And they're reasoning so early. It, you know, we have this sort of sense, well, they're not thinking, they're not doing anything really. They're sort of blobs almost, you know, until they're six. And but so much is going on.
Yeah, until and up to 3 years old, all the brain cells don't have come up. It's just amazing at how much effect you can have on your child in a positive way. And nothing that's terribly hard. I mean, you read to them, you talk to them, you love them, you know, you can do that. It's not that you have to read them a certain something, you know, that's very, you know, it doesn't, that kind of thing isn't, it's that you read to them, you talk to them, the language and that kind of stuff. It's just amazing.
This guy Matthews at Amherst, he does all this stuff with trying to bring philosophy back into the schools, into the elementary schools. Because he says, like, that age, like 4 to 8 especially, so many fundamental questions coming out, like little Plato's, you know, in a sense, just asking these fundamental questions. And he also, he says, if you start taking it seriously and really ask, what are they saying about this, you really learn a lot yourself. And kind of look at maybe a piece of artwork a little different way, or a situation a little bit different way than you had, if you just listen to what they're saying. So I found that work very interesting. I was kind of wondering, are there any kinds, different kinds of language you use to talk about this, whether it's, you know, maybe not vocation or calling, but are there other ways, like you were saying, not what do you want to be, but how what do you want to be like? Are there other ways you've talked to children you love that you think has been helpful? Or any other activities that I didn't mention that you thought really opened up a different way of thinking for them, where they were able to see more clearly their gifts, how they can serve?
I think it's really still that there's a weakness to us, and so that our lives constantly change. We still...
Their what change?
Our lives.
Oh, yeah, our change. Lives, yeah.
I mean, I'm 54, and I'm still not sure what I'm going to be when I grow up. And I find with my children and my friends' children, you know, we all talk to them, that they value hearing us talk about how we're going, where we're going, whether we're meeting our priorities, how we're using our time. So really not even necessarily saying what they ought to be doing, because that's often too scary. But for them to hear us still talking about our own lives, about weighing up the priorities and balances and what we think we're good at, and maybe we need to develop a new area.
Talking out loud with them.
I mean, that's a good
about point. How you're struggling.
Because most people don't think, I mean, that's a great way to put it, I'm 54 and I still don't know what I'm going to be when I grow up. I mean, it's good for our kids to hear that. But, I mean, my kids look at me and they think, well, gee, Dad, you're vice president of Luther College and that's what you're going to be. But I'm continuing to evolve and grow and learn and try to figure out the callings that I have and things that I can offer, because it's not just the job, it's what we do in church and community and society and career, everything, and, you know, the family and church and all that together. So I love that, just to say, well, kind of once in a while at the family table, wonder what I'm going to be when I grow up. Dad, you're supposed to be growing up already. You know, we talk about, a lot of the colleges have these sort of gimmicky little slogans or whatever. It was, Augustana's was enter to learn, leave to serve.
Enter to learn, leave to serve.
Which is a great I think it's a great motto. We talk about it doesn't matter what you're going to do, it matters who you're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the calling and serving their church and community and careers. And, you know, there's a lot of that happens in those sort of healthy, positive environments of church colleges, but one of your questions was what happens outside of the church-related colleges?
Yeah.
What happens outside of the church-related schools? Are some of those same questions being asked in non-denominational areas?
Yeah.
It's kind of nice that we have Lilly grants that allow us to ask those questions and work with kids and help mm-hmm. them through advisors and mm-hmm. a lot of time, but only 5% right. of our Lutheran kids that graduate go to Lutheran colleges.
Right. And I wanted to ask that because some people had questions too about what about the role of even going to church? So many people struggle even just going to church because part of the reason Lilly wants to give so much money is the people on the board there aren't able to find churches where they have good preaching anymore. And part of the grant was, you know, to help foster very good ordained ministers who can be leaders in the community and wonderful preachers. But the other part was to help everybody think about how do you serve and think about this rich notion of vocation. But I think a lot of people struggle. I haven't found a good church. What do I do? Is it important that I go to that weekly service? Or then they start asking questions about the parochial school. Should we put them in the parochial school? And then the church-related college. So I'd like to hear people's thoughts about that. Yeah?
Well, I mean, my own experience is brief teaching at a at the Evergreen State College here in Washington, but it seems that the good professors are raising all those questions mm-hmm. all the time, whether it's at a secular school or a religious school, that they're really trying to help kids find the path to serve, use their gifts to serve. I mean, I don't know that that's necessarily everywhere, but it's certainly,
mm-hmm.
I observed a lot of people wanting to do that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, if you take your teaching seriously and are not really talking about working with young people, one thing nice I do like about the Lutheran tradition there is this sense God is working everywhere in the so-called secular realm, that it's not all, we have to be totally counterculture or it's all bad outside the church. You know, that's kind of the evil world out there. There is a sense, something in the structure of the way things are or people's professions, that it gets carried through this message. I found it kind of interesting, too. I think a lot of good things happen. And actually, the Lutheran schools have had this great survey. You probably know a lot about that, don't you? Where they were able to do a very extensive survey about the young people who've been to Lutheran institutions. And they do have a high percentage of commitment to their communities, of involvement in the schools, involvement in political life. And that was kind of...
I was on
the
research team for that, if you want.
Oh, were you?
It's just amazing. And, of course, we used it to market our schools. I mean...
Yes, to market.
Always something about...
Right.
Yeah. But the point was, you know, that asking people from flagship public universities and from other private, what we would call aspirational colleges that would be, you know, considered very positive places, and then... asking graduates of the Lutheran colleges and universities. And it was amazing the high response of things, for example, in areas where it's important that I'm involved in my church, or I'm involved in a leadership role in my church, or mm-hmm. community, mm-hmm. church, career, all those things. And it was more than just the job. It was what you did and how you served it. And
it was neat. And it is nice at a church like that, they have the language at least to keep helping you, encouraging you as professors, as people on the staff, to use that kind of language. You know, I think, but certainly not, wouldn't be exclusive, but I think it is important then to make sure your children do get around people who are helping ask those questions. And that's one thing where, you know, if it's just you and your family, it's very hard. You've got to have other people kind of reaffirming, confirming, kind of that larger vision. I think especially today when it's hard.
Well, that may also, though, come from the fact that the kids who come to those schools have that kind of upbringing and
yeah.
were taught maybe to take it more seriously when it was presented to them, whereas in the public colleges, the professors may have presented the same kinds of things about values, but it didn't have the reinforcement of being raised in that kind of family.
They're very capable of thinking very independently once they're at college. And I know that one of the things we're trying to really focus on, and I know it's happening here in North America, both Canada and the USA, is getting students to do group work rather than individual projects. And you have to convince professors too, but the idea is so that people learn to cooperate and work in teams and value one all the different talents everybody brings to a team in quite secular contexts.
Mm-hmm.
But we find it hardest to do in areas such as commerce, economics,
mm-hmm.
science, and it's really, really hard to first of all convince the professors. And also to then, if you convince the professors, for them to try and get the students to do it. There's a kind of high competitive mentality that often goes along with certain subjects and certain domains of study.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you go into the social sciences, it's not so hard.
Mm-hmm.
Because people want to look at valuing difference and the rights of humans and caring for the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not always sort of quite that simple, you know, you have
yeah.
to sort of break it down.
Mm-hmm. I think some of the schools are now trying to do more, you know, in business, especially when these, you know, terrible things are happening in some of these companies, and you know, unethical behavior, that they want to start bringing some of this up, and you know, these many of these jobs do serve the community. These different kinds of professions are a service to all of us. You know, if they're carried out with compassion and justice, Luther said there's a few jobs aren't so great, prostitution, being a thief, you know, they aren't such great things. But even the ones we hold up as valuable, we have to always watch out, are we carrying them out with justice and compassion? Like being a, he talked about being a baker and how much you pay somebody and trying to do that fairly. So thinking about, I think more schools are trying to think about it, partly because of some of the problems that have come up in companies, but we hope they'll do some more of that. But yeah, it's funny too, I think sometimes with this church-related college and secular, sometimes the secular ones have been models in certain ways, like fairness about diversity or pay for gender, or, you know, women and men trying equal pay. Sometimes the secular ones have been a little ahead. Or like Oberlin, my gosh, it's such a model environmentally. You know, just as they have this environmental center there at Oberlin or Middlebury, it's not a church-related college, but they've done so much as an institution to show they're committed to kind of responsibility to future generations, to the community, to the earth. And sometimes they are models, you know, I think, for church-related colleges. But it is nice in some way to be intentional with young people, that they find other people around them using some kind of similar language, a little different angle, but the same emphasis on service. That certainly does help everybody, say. I think we have to stop, yeah. So, well, thank you so much. And if you have any other thoughts, that I'd appreciate hearing more about what you think, you know, about these ideas. Well, thank you.
Thank you.